Welcome to the Pin Down, your Detroit Pistons podcast. I'm your host, Wes Davenport from Motor City Hoops and Detroit Bad Boys.
And I'm Blake Silverman, writer for Detroit Bad Boys, covering everything from the Pistons to the NBA draft and the Motor City Cruise.
All right, Blake, I got to say thank you. You know, we're doing this right in the middle of March Madness starting up. Anyone who's watching right now live with us on YouTube or on Twitter, thanks for taking a break from all the games that are going on and tuning in for some Pistons basketball. But I wanted to start with just this. Why don't you give me just one March Madness hot take? You know, it could be anything. Doesn't have to just be basketball. But give me a hot take about March Madness this year.
Oh, man, I love it. And yeah, thank you to everyone who's joining us live in the midst of debatably like the two best sports days of the year to just park it on the couch and watch hoops all day. It's great. I'm excited for the whole weekend, the next few weeks. My hot take, and definitely a little in the weeds, but I'm going to go with Duquesne getting to the second weekend. They just won today over BYU. They're going to be playing Illinois. I just love their story. Like, it's definitely a little bit of a hot take. They started 0-5 in conference play. Their head coach, Keith Dambrot, announced he's retiring after their tournament run. He also coached LeBron James in high school at St. Vincent St. Mary's. So I just love the story and like things like that, that you can only get in March. And while they might have a little bit of like a tough opponent and it's going to be really extremely difficult to get by Illinois, maybe they can do it. I'm rooting for them. What's your hot take?
Well, it'd definitely be fun. I don't think they're getting past Illinois though. I mean, we got to root for the
it's a hot take,
right? It is, you know, it is a hot take. I respect the heat of that take. For me, mine's not even basketball related, Blake. I just think that these games all need to start later in the day. Like, give me all of the games starting at like 4, pack them in and go really late at night, because I was busy at work all day, started early in the morning, had to watch something, take notes down, a bunch of meetings. Long story short, I haven't even gotten to watch a minute of March Madness basketball yet today. And that is just unacceptable. They need to change the rules for me entirely. So they need to push the start time back so that I could be included in all the fun.
Man, I think you and me both just need to like schedule our PTO calendar a little bit better. Like, I've always wanted to take these 2 days off specifically from work just so I can park it and watch basketball day. Like, something's come up where I haven't, but next year that's a goal of mine. Take this Thursday and Friday off. Luckily, I have been able to watch most of it. Lucky for me as a Michigan State fan that worked out well since they were the first game of the day. But yeah, I think that's definitely a goal of mine, that one we can share now as well for next year.
Well, and I'll just say, I think the killer for me this year was that I actually had to sit down and watch something for work, which in the past, right, you know, you're able to like set up the iPad over here while you're typing away on the computer. But this year I did have to pay attention to what was going on in front of me. And that, you know, that was a real bummer for me. So yes, Bryce, my guy, Bryce, I will stay up till 3 or 5 a.m. I don't care. I will stay up all night watching March Madness basketball. Just push the start time back for me. That's all I ask. And it's not a big ask at all. It's, you know, they should just do it.
Yeah. Hey, at least my hot take might be able to happen. I don't know if we'll ever get to yours, but I feel your pain, especially today. I was working as well and kind of had to pick and choose when I was watching.
All right. Speaking of pain, let's get to a less fun topic here. And it's unavoidable. I do want to talk quickly about the end of that Miami game, the one that they lost by 3. It was on March 17th, 104-101 Miami. Obviously, Cade Cunningham kind of burns the clock down, takes a final shot with 10 seconds remaining, misses. The Heat come down the floor and nail a dagger 3 at the buzzer to win the game. So just, you know, from your perspective, when you were watching it, name some things that went wrong there. I mean, there's quite a bit, but just give a rundown of all the problems that happened there with those final probably 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to go back to like the decision that Cade made to drive it and get that shot up with like 10 or 11 seconds left, whatever it was. I know after the game he said that he liked his matchup. He had Jaime Jaquez Jr. guarding him and he sensed a double was coming, so that's why he went for it. I mean, it's still a bad decision. Like it was a tie game. You had the ball. You could have taken the last shot and you didn't. And then you saw what happened on the other end of the floor. And I mean, it was just kind of like storybook what the Heat did coming. But it speaking of March Madness, it kind of reminded me of the game winner that Villanova had against North Carolina. That's just like, you know, one of the most notable shots of all time. Of course, this happened in a much less high intensity scenario, but like when you have a guy who's what made like a handful of threes all year, not that many in his career, get a handoff to him, get it up. Like it was one of those that you knew was kind of falling when he got it up, and it was just decision making. Like that's what they paid for. I think Cade knows it. I'm not really like faulting him for it moving forward, but in the moment, it was definitely a horrible decision.
Yeah, well, and I think long run, right? This kind of reminded me a little bit of Jaden Ivey in his rookie year calling that timeout against the Chicago Bulls while he was inbounding the ball late in a game when they, in fact, did not have any timeouts left. Obviously, that's a technical. Jaden Ivey kind of blamed himself for the loss, all that stuff. Long story short, I don't think this is necessarily going to happen again. It's probably one of those things you don't forget as a player. But I did want to talk about one bit of this whole situation, and that is I was curious if you thought Monty Williams maybe should have called a timeout there, because to me it looked like there are two pretty distinct problems. Obviously Cade should not take that shot. He needs to wind the clock down at least to five or six so that maybe you have a tip-in attempt, and if anything's going back the other way, it's kind of a three-quarter court heave, right? So that's inexcusable. There's no way around that. But at the same time, I might have preferred it if Monty Williams used that final timeout he had to draw up some kind of action. Probably not a pick and roll. I don't know with how Miami had been doubling Cade that game that you would want to bring a second defender to him, but maybe something off ball with a shooter just to attract some attention and maybe open up a driving lane for Cade to get to. And obviously this, relies on a sideline out of bounds play, which they had admittedly struggled with. So there are pros and cons with all this. But what are your thoughts on potentially calling a timeout in that situation, whether that may have been worth it or not?
Yeah, I mean, I understand it definitely. And like, I understand those that were saying that Monty should have called a timeout in that scenario. And like, looking to that first and foremost, I kind of like just letting your young team and your young star who you're building around just kind of like run with it. Like, the game doesn't mean anything in the long run. Obviously, you want to get that win and do whatever you can to do it. But I kind of, it, I mean, I don't even know if I want to say like, but like I understood just letting them run through with that possession and let, I mean, obviously what it resulted in was a mistake that hopefully they're learning from and will clean up and make better sense of a similar situation moving forward. I get like those saying that he should have called a timeout, made some adjustments, draw something up, but I'm not like super mad at it by any means. Maybe it's because this game is a little bit happened a few days ago now, and I've had more time to think about it rather than what I was thinking at in the moment. But I definitely like, I'm not super mad at Monty for not calling a timeout in that scenario.
Yeah, I think in the moment, for me, I was more not well, I was most upset about the shot. The shot immediately was a "what the heck are you doing" situation. But in the moment, I was pretty upset that the timeout wasn't called. I think as time has gone on, I've talked to my guy Bryce here, who's in the comments, Bryce Simon, Motor City Hoops, and obviously the Pistons Pulse. Shout out to Pistons Pulse podcast. Talking to him, and he's more of the guy as a coach when he coached that would just kind of let the players go through it and make something of it themselves. And so I do get that. I do get that part of it. And I want to make sure too that, you know, through this discussion, we delineate that shot that Cade took is not fixed necessarily by the timeout. Like, you wouldn't call a timeout as a coach and say, and guys, make sure to remember, don't shoot the ball with 10 seconds left because the other team has an opportunity to go and take another shot on the other end. Like, that's unspoken. Everyone should know that already. You're not going to call a timeout for that. What bothered me, and still, it's a lesser of a bother now because I do understand what you just said, and I don't fully disagree with it. But I do think if you could have gotten that ball in, it would have been nice to see some action off the ball and away from the isolation, just so that double team that Cade felt coming his way when he pulled the trigger on that shot isn't as close, and he has a little bit more time to react to it. I'm not saying that would have resulted in a different outcome. He still might have shot it with 10 seconds left, you know, like, and that's on him. That there's no way around that. But just a pure four low ISO there to end the game, I didn't love that call. I would have liked the timeout to get some different action going.
Yeah. I mean, I totally understand it too. I guess just like mainly where I am is I'm not super mad about it. Like in the moment, should it have been handled differently by the players on the court, by the coaching staff? Probably. I mean, definitely like in Cade's perspective. But I just hope it's something that they learn from and grow from and know, like, we actually need to do something to make something good happen in that situation, or the repercussion is exactly what happened in this Miami game.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got an interesting question. Well, I guess, you know, two of the same comment, but one's a question. So I wanted to bring this up from Bryce. He said he would have rather had some sort of action be run, but wonders if maybe Cade wanted that four low ISO. And then our guy YouTube user here, he's wondering, what do you think just in general about the ISO as the last play for that game? So what do you think? You know, would you have wanted to see something else called there, or were you all right with the four low ISO?
I mean, yeah, you just want to get a clean look. And I guess it was pretty clear that Cade wasn't getting that, whether the double was coming or not. Like, we saw the shot that he put up. So I think, like, whatever you have to do to get your star player open, and I mean, that might happen. Like, they're probably going to put a couple guys on him, and then maybe someone else floats out and gets a clean look. Like, I just think you need to do whatever you can to get the best look possible in that scenario. In this game that doesn't really matter in the long run, I guess I understand letting your young star just go with an isolation and hopefully he can make something happen and get like a game winning bucket. And you never know like what the momentum can be building off that. I definitely don't think it's a good like basketball move what happened, both like schematically and the decision that Cade made. But I kind of just understand it in the context of this team and this season.
I think what really sucks about this whole situation that happened there was that, you know, for all of the concern that many of us, myself included, have about just Cade Cunningham beating guys off of pure isolation, especially with the double team coming, for all that concern, he did get a good shot. Like, it was a good look that he got from three. The problem was it was just about 5 seconds too early. So, you know, that's a little unfortunate bit of irony, I guess, because I do agree with what you said, at least on principle, the idea of, hey, we're going to put it in the hands of our young star and it's going to be a learning experience whether or not he makes it. Like, I do get that. I think it's a good point. So let's dive into actually some questions here. We've got this one from the DBB comments. This is from KCP for three, and it's through. He says, I've seen enough to know that Cade and Ivy just won't work out. It should have in theory, and I, being KCP for three, and it's through, think that Ivy will be a good player at some point, but it's not working. Do you think they should move on this offseason?
I mean, I think if Ivy's like shooting woes continue, like if that's who he is as a shooter, like I don't know if he's like the best person to put next to Cade. I don't like, I'm not going to say today that, yes, they need to move on from Jade and Ivy, but I think it's a conversation. I mean, it's sort of like the hot topic across like Pistons Twitter, the Pistons fan community this week is like, is this quote unquote core four going to work together? And you know, like two and a half, maybe like three of them are not shooters. And that's like, that's not going to win you games. That's not going to put you in a position to contend for a playoff spot, let alone anything like meaningful in the long run. So I think it all hinges on like what he is as a shooter. Like we've seen flashes where he's looked great and then just a bunch of stretches where he hasn't. So is that what he truly is? I don't know, but it's definitely something that you're questioning a lot based on this like slump, or if it's even a slump that he's going through right now. What do you think, Wes?
To me, you know, I think this is more of an organizational question than it is a Cade and Ivy question. Because like, you know, like KCP for 3 and 3 says, like it works on paper. It does. You know, they do fit well together. The problem right now, or at least during this most recent stretch here after the All-Star break, is how they've been using Jade and Ivy. To me, I think that's the issue. I'm not sure exactly if it's Jade and Ivy himself just settling for these looks, but I suspect that it's not. You know, I suspect it's a little deeper. It seems to me, especially with how Fournier has been able to succeed at times in the exact role and with the same, you know, shot diet that Jade and Ivy's been taking, it seems to me that this is just kind of the role that Monty Williams wants his two guard next to Cade Cunningham to have. And that's a guy that's not getting a ton of ball screens, but he's getting some, a lot of catch and shoot looks, a lot of DHOs, and just a little bit of ISO as well. So, you know, if that's going to be what you ask Jade and Ivy to do, I'm not sure if it's going to work out. If we can change, you know, what we're asking of Jade and Ivy, right, as a coach, as an organization, as just an offense in general, however you want to phrase it, if that can change, then I do think that it can work. So to me, you know, should they move on, the first question they need to ask is this really what we want next to Cade? And this being the type of role, the type of shots that they're currently setting up for next decade, the type of shots that Evan Fournier is really good at, but Jaden Ivey's not. And so that's my question at this point. You know, do you have any thoughts on I guess the usage of Jaden Ivey and what that might mean here for the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, I think he could, like, when Ivy was coming off the bench and there was a similar, not the same, but a similar question, like, earlier in the season on whether he would be the one young piece they would be okay with moving on from. Like, my worry or scare, which, I mean, you'll have this always, is just he's the perfect archetype of a guy who you trade and he lands in a perfect situation and his game just like pops. And it's one of those things that you look at that's like, oh man, like, but it's a situational thing. Like, maybe it's would never happen for him here in a different situation where he's more of that like primary ball handler scorer, like offensive cog. Maybe that makes him really pop. But I think like what Bryce brought up here, and shout out to you, Bryce, for joining with us. I'm sure if everyone is here, you're already listening to the Pistons Pulse with Bryce, Omari, and Wes. But if you're not, change that immediately. But he's right. Bryce is saying, like, if Ivy offensively is not a great fit next to Cade, like, why are we not talking about Asar Thompson? I think we could even, like, extend that. I mean, different roles, of course. But, like, Durin being a non-shooter is, like, another issue with this whole thing. Like, Asar is a non-shooter. Durin's a non-shooter. Ivy is not shooting the ball well. So like, I think the crux of the issue is just like putting players that can shoot next to Cade Cunningham. And if Ivy can't be that, when right now he looks like the one guy that should be that, like, what do you do in the long run? Which I don't know.
Well, and I think something I've been thinking about, honestly, most of this season is like, you know, sticking with the question Bryce asked there, you know, like Asar Thompson individually is a good fit next to Cade. Jaden Ivey individually is a good fit next to Cade, assuming they're going to use him in a way that maximizes Jaden Ivey's gifts on offense. Jalen Duren individually, very good fit next to Cade on offense. But you put them all together, and that shooting weakness really pops up, and then they all become not a great fit, right? Yeah. And you know, that's why having Isaiah Stewart as a four who, you know, can't do much other than catch and shoot threes at this point offensively, but is a good defender. That's why he's been so important when he was healthy for that, you know, foursome there to succeed. I just think that they're going to be in a situation here this offseason where picking between these four guys is going to be in the cards. I don't know if they're going to do it. You know, I don't know if they're actually going to move on from any one or two of these guys. But, you know, Cade definitely seems to be the guy, quote unquote. And moving forwards, it's probably a question of who fits best around Cade. And who fits best around Cade in a way that is a good schematic fit with the offense Monty Williams wants to run. And in that, you know, I'm not sure that Ivy answers that second question in the positive. And actually, I'm not sure Jalen Duren does either. And it's just going to be a really interesting offseason. To see what happens with those two guys, I think. Are you getting the same sense?
Yeah, I mean, sort of like you said, I'm not really convinced that they're going to move on from any of the young pieces. It's just one of those things for me that I'll believe it when I see it. And, like, I understand it, too. I would be nervous to trade Ivy, Duren, Asar Thompson if he's on the table. And honestly, like, I think Duren is like a decent fit for what Monty is trying to do. I just think, like you said, Wes, the context of putting him next to a non-shooter like Asar, a guy like Ivy who is struggling right now and we don't know what the shot's going to be. Like, having a floor spacing big who can shoot the three a little bit would like really open things up. I mean, we saw it very briefly with Mike Muscala, and not saying by any means that he's like the answer, but just someone in that archetype. Like, you see what Chet does for OKC. Like, we're not going to find anyone like Chet this offseason, but just someone like that, I think, makes a lot of those questions a lot easier, whether it's in the wing next to Cade. Like, and hopefully you can have someone who plays defense and can space the floor a little bit as you're big.
And that is why I have Alex Saar as my number one pick. Anyway, let's bring some news
here. Hey, I'm not fully convinced on the shot, but that's a conversation for another day.
Definitely. So we did have some news break over the past week. Asar Thompson and Isaiah Stewart are both going to be out for the remainder of the season. Asar Thompson with a blood clot that they thankfully caught, and Isaiah Stewart with an ankle strain, going to be out for the rest of the year. They signed Chaz Metu to a 10-day contract. I believe he played in Phoenix with Monty Williams in the past. So there's
he just signed a one-year deal this year. With Phoenix. He spent most of his time in the NBA in Sacramento.
Right.
And yeah, I believe he signed a one-year deal this year and then was dealt at the deadline to Memphis, who waived him. And when Phoenix David Roddy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So no Monty overlap. There goes my thought on that. But anyway,
it was a good idea.
It was a good idea. Yeah. We also did have the Pistons tie a record you don't really want to tie. After the Pacers game, they had used 30 different players that suited up in a Pistons uniform this season. And that ties an NBA record with the Houston Rockets. So if they have another, you know, long-term injury and sign someone else, you could see that record broken. And it's just a little bit more infamy to add to this season that has not gone all that well.
Yeah, and the 30 players was something that was like eye-opening. I mean, I saw it got to 28 the game before, but yeah, I don't know. It's just something that makes you realize like how crazy the season was. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, because like when we were going through that losing streak, everyone was begging for change, and like 30 players is change. I mean, I know some of the guys, like the two-way guys that have come in, are not going to be people that are totally going to turn your team around. But hey, we can't say we haven't seen a crazy mix of players this season.
All right. So talking about, you know, this offseason and all of the different players that have played for the Pistons this year, I wanted to get to this question here from S. Michael 69 in the DBB comments. He asks, what would be the case for the Pistons not being a bottom five team next year? And he wants that case to be made on internal development alone. Okay, so you're not projecting that they're going to sign somebody big, make a big trade for somebody. What is the case? And I'll add, is there a case to be made that the Pistons won't be a bottom five team next year if they basically run it back and add a top five pick from this upcoming offseason?
Okay, I'm sort of like trying to find a way for this to come to life just with like the roster and everything that's in-house right now. I think where my mind jumps immediately is like, one, we just talked about it for a while, like Ivy coming along as a shooter, just putting together what we've seen from him in the past at stretches for a full season. And I'm actually like, I thought about what like Simone Fontecchio would need to do if he's like a long-term starter, but I'm actually going to go to Quentin Grimes. I think if he, whether we see him anymore this season or if it's next season, just seeing his shot come along too, because if he's able to come back and shoot the ball like we know he's been able to in the past, and defend at the level that we know he defends, like putting a guy like that in your starting lineup, whether it's next to Cade without Ivy, with Ivy next to Asar Thompson and Jalen Duren, like we spent so much time on like the shooting issues within the main group for this team. If a guy like Quentin Grimes is able to come in and shoot like 38, 40% from three and consistently take either a primary or secondary option defensively on the other end of the floor, like I think you really got something there, and you're sort of cleaning up some of the holes that we've been talking about.
All right, here's what I want to bring up quickly. So to be a not bottom five team, you know, this season, the Pistons are basically 8 games behind exiting that threshold right now. That's a lot. You know, we talked about it entering into the season and very early into this season. You know, even a double digit win improvement year over year is pretty dang rare in the NBA. It is hard to do, and it doesn't happen that often. 8 games is a lot. It just is. So, you know, if you're not going to make relatively big changes this offseason, if you're going to bank on internal development and basically run it back, I think, you know, to me, I think the argument for not being a bottom five team is basically like waving a hypothetical magic wand around and saying, okay, now Asar Thompson's going to shoot league average from three, and Jaden Ivey's going to be a 25-point-a-night scorer, and Jalen Duren's going to be a good rim protector. Like, and your top five pick is going to be usable right away in a starting role and very efficient as a scorer and three-point shooter. Like, all things that, I'm sorry to say, are not going to happen in one offseason, and truthfully might not ever happen, no matter how much time you give these guys. Like, Ausar Thompson shooting 17% from three this season. He needs to improve almost 20 percentage points to get to league average. Jalen Duren is, I think we talked last week, he was averaging like 2.6, almost three turnovers a night in the past five or six games. Like, that's a problem, cutting that back down, and also then becoming a good shot blocker when he, I believe, has had two or three blocks total in the past six or seven games. Like, that's a lot to ask. It's just a lot to ask of these guys in only one offseason. So I just don't think that there's an argument to be made at all. Like, they need to do something. I don't know if doing something means trading one of these, you know, four core guys. It might not. There are other avenues to improving the roster. But if we're purely going to focus on internal development, like, I don't want to sound super negative, but I just don't think it's possible.
Yeah, and I mean, you said it, like, our guy YouTube user brings it up, like, Duren on defense, like, I sort of focus on the offensive end, but defense is a huge issue as well. And like, I know we're going to talk about some, like, what we want or what we think should happen in the offseason, but a big priority for that needs to be a defensive minded big, because if you have Jalen Duren and James Wiseman, who has been looking better as a rim protector, but we don't know if he's going to be around next year. And he's just not, like, he's not defense first. I think you just need a big that is gonna, you can rely on to, like, go in there and protect the rim, play defense, which you don't really have on the roster other than Isaiah Stewart, which we don't know if we're going to see him in that role for the long term. So yeah, I'm with you there.
All right, staying on Jalen Duren. We got this one from Kian Ross. Hopefully I said that correctly. He says, has anybody asked Monty about Duren's play as of late, at least after the last win? The answer to that directly is, to my knowledge, no. But he says, not sure if Duren is injured, bad habits, freelancing, experimenting with ball handling and passes, or what. The implication here is that Jalen Duren's not playing good basketball right now. I would tend to agree. So, Blake, you know, what do you make of Jalen Duren's recent play? What might be driving it? And, you know, if this is fixable or just kind of who he is?
Yeah, what's interesting to me is, like, thinking back on the first handful of games of the season, like, before he went out with injury, like, he sort of wasn't a totally different player, but he sort of came out and, like, dominated to start the year, and then he dealt with those ankle injuries on and off, so we don't know if he's still dealing with that, if it's impacting him at all. But, you know, it's, we've been talking about his lapses, or I guess, like, what he's lacking on the defensive end for a while, and also the processing, decision making stuff. So I don't know, like, Wes, I know you've said in the past, we're not sure if he can ever be a good defender in this league. Like, I think it'll take a lot for him to get to that point. Like, what he is right now is sort of just like a rim running guy, like, lob threat who can get you some buckets near the rim, rebound the ball. But he also, like we've talked about, gives up offensive rebounds as well, which result in easy buckets. So I don't know, like, I want to say it's something that can be fixed through development and additional summer, but I'm not fully convinced about that right now.
All right, I'm about to ask you an admittedly leading question, but I'm gonna ask it anyway, since I just, you know, threw that out there ahead of time. Jalen Duren pre-draft, so his draft profile, did he have defensive concerns back then, you know, at the time? Do you recall?
I mean, I think if I recall correctly, I think it was just how, like, raw he was, because he was, like, the youngest player in that draft class, was the youngest player in the NBA. Now he's the youngest, like, second year guy. So I think it was always something that was going to come around, or not going to come around, but you hoped would come around. And with his, like, frame and athleticism and everything like that, you figured it would, but after this season, we're just like not really sure.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to bring up. You know, pre-draft, there were concerns about his defense in the immediate, which means he was not a great defender at the time. Bryce brings up the other concern, which was motor. I do remember that as well, and we've kind of seen that. Actually, this is interesting. So this is Bryce. This is from his scout at the time. Defending ball screens. I am not buying the switchability yet. Starting to buy more and more. I think it just does not always seem like he's focused and engaged, and he commits a little too high at times. So that's even on the switchability aspect, right? Where he just didn't really have it at the time, but you could see maybe there was some potential there. I only bring these things up to say Jalen Duren was not a good defender in college. He was not a good defender his rookie year. He had a 4-game stretch to start this season where he was a pretty good defender. And then since then, he's been bad. He's been not a good defender again. At some point, he's just not a good defender, right? I mean, we're about to enter year 3 for him. And all we have to grasp to is a 4-game stretch. So, and where I'm going with this is also something that Bryce put in the chat here. And that's that, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean you need to move on from Jalen Duren. But what it means is that if you keep him, if you prioritize him, your perimeter defense needs to be really good at almost every position on the court. All right. Cade needs to improve. Asar Thompson's great. And then you're going to need to improve on Isaiah Stewart, who's not an amazing perimeter defender, but he's a good perimeter defender for a big. So you need to improve that one. And you definitely need to improve on Jaden Ivey, because right now, with the way that guards are able to get past the perimeter defense and get to the rim, Jalen Duren's not going to provide any sort of protection there. So I think, again, here, you know, we're looking at a choice. It's a choice. Are you going to, you know, make a change there at the 5 position, or is Jalen Duren good enough as an offensive prospect and as a rebounder for you to prioritize? Either answer to that question has ranging effects on the rest of the roster if you want to build this thing out. They're in a tough position, especially with how he's been playing recently, don't you think?
Yeah, and like with everything we've heard coming from the organization on like how big a priority defense is, like that sort of makes you think one thing. But I mean, if it's, say you're debating, there's like a deal on the table that the team likes and they have to give up either like Ivy and or Duren, like that's a concern for both of them. So yeah, it's interesting. And like you said, like it seems funny looking back to it, that stretch at the start of the season, that's what we're looking back to say like, yeah, maybe there's something there, but everything else we've seen, it has been like a consistent concern, which is definitely worrisome. Like he's still very young. So I don't want to say like nothing can improve or anything like that, but yeah, it's becoming like harder to see, I guess. And it like you said, it might just depend the direction that the team wants to go.
All right, so we got this next one here from KCP for 3, and it's through. This is from the DPP comments section. He says, what should the Pistons realistically pay Simone Fontecchio this summer? And I know we've touched on this before, but with the injury that he's dealing with currently and the fact that he hit that starting threshold, so his cap hold technically here went up by about $2 million or so, which, you know, relatively small potatoes for the Pistons, who have, you know, the most cap space, I believe, to play around with in the league. But where are you on Fontecchio's next contract? And have you kind of changed your expectation since the last we spoke about it? Or are you still kind of in that 15 to 20 range as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that still sounds right to me. Maybe a little more closer to 15 than I was thinking the last time. But so I looked up just some like players in that range that are right around like 15 a year, and some names I came up with that are more like, I guess, role guys are like Lou Dort, Luke Kennard, KCP, Max Strus. And then you also have Gary Harris, who is at $13 million a year, and he's 29 years old. So, I mean, I think something around that sounds right, especially if, like, Fontecchio is not going to be a starter long-term. I mean, I'm not saying that he's as good or, like, better than really any of those guys, but I think that range still sounds right to me in terms of, like, what he's going to be, like, asked to do. And I feel like there's a team out there that would pay him around $15 million a year on like a 2 or 3 year deal. I know he's second year in the NBA, but older, I think that's still on the table for what he brings, guys who can shoot the ball at his height and that like archetype are hard to get. Maybe the Pistons, I don't think they'll have to pay more to keep him around, but I think it's that number, especially not even talking about like the cap going up. Like, I think when we first discussed this is I brought up that like Marvin Bagley's $12 million a year kind of stuck out to me. And that 15 was kind of just going for whatever the cap rises to. So that sounds right to me, like at or around or hopefully even like below 15 for him.
All right. So to me, I'm going to lean back on what I said last time. I'm really sticking to it. And I think that it's going to be much closer to 20. And specifically because I think the guys you mentioned are pretty good comparisons, right? Like especially Luke Kennard, KCP, and Max Strus. I think those are all pretty solid comps for a type of contract that Fontecchio is going to get. The problem is those guys signed their contracts in the past, and we're about to go into the future. In the future, the cap's going up. So that number's going to inflate quite a bit. And not only is the cap going up, but it's going up quickly over the course of these next few seasons. So to me, I still think you're looking at 18 to 20. I think it's going to be on the upper side of this. And that's not even going to be ridiculous either. I think we brought up last time, I think the percentage of the cap if he's paid 20 is right around 14%, which means you could have, you know, 8 Fontecchios just about at that deal. You know, that's bench player money. That's how this works. You know, this reminds me a little bit of the conversation last offseason on Stewart's extension. You know, it seemed like quite a bit for a guy that long term you hope is on the bench, but in reality, it's only a couple mil more than the mid-level exception. And that's what Fontecchio is going to be at. If you pay him $18 to $20 million as a salary in a few years, in a couple years, yeah, it's only a couple mil over the mid-level exception. That's just how this is going to go. I think if he could get him at 15, that's a steal. I just don't foresee that happening. I think it's going to bump up just a little bit here to closer to 20. Probably not over, though. It does feel to me like that would be the limit where I start to get uncomfortable with it. You know, would you agree with that there too, that, you know, okay, if it's 20, it's understandable. If it's higher, and now it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, especially if like he's not gonna start. Like, I think it's a very real possibility that the deal he gets, there could be a little sticker shock, but it wouldn't concern me immediately just because of like the cap going up and everything. And like, what is Stewart's like right on 15 mil a year, right? So yeah, I think like something around like that range, if it's a little higher, because like you said, we're moving forward into a larger salary cap, that makes sense. But yeah, if you're getting to like over 20, I think that's a lot for what you're going to be asking him to do. But this team needs someone who can shoot the ball. Like, he's not known for his defense, but hopefully he's improving in that sense and is not a total like negative or nothing on that end of the floor. So yeah, I mean, I don't want them to overpay him by any means. Like, I'm sensing it's going to be a deal that is like good for both parties.
I certainly hope so.
And I don't know anything to prove that, but that's just what I feel.
No, you know, we got to go for sunshine and rainbows sometimes. This has been kind of a negative podcast episode so far. So I like the positive outlook, Blake. I really do. This next question here, this is from our guy Bryce. He says, Awoma, Amude, Metu, or Buddy Boeheim, who is most likely to be on the 15-man roster to start next season? I love this question. What do you got?
That's a good one. All right. I'm going to debate between Tosin Awoma and Stanley Amude. While Metu, I feel like, is a good one, I just like don't know what's going to happen after the 10-day contract. So while it would make sense for him to stick around, I guess I just like don't know it. And Buddy, he's improved as like an all-around player. And he's going crazy in the G League this year. We saw him with the Pistons for the first time last night. Like, he brings you the shooting that you need. It's just like, I don't see it long term. So I'm going to go with Stanley just because he did sign that like non-guaranteed 2-year deal. I think he's like proved a lot within the organization. He wasn't even on like, he was on a two-way deal to start the year, but he didn't get that until like, right before the season. So he sort of worked his way to that and then got the full NBA deal. So I just think he's done a lot. He's played well. He can shoot the ball. But also Tosin, like, I just think there's an NBA player in there. Like, Memphis picked him up on a 10-day before Detroit did and after he played for the G League. So I could see that one too, both of those, but I lean towards Stanley.
I agree with you on that. Like, if I'm going to make the pick, it's going to be Amude. But just for fun, I'll play devil's advocate here. And I'm going to say Buddy Boeheim just wow. for fun to make the argument, because you got to give him a little bit of credit where it's due. If you think back to his first summer league performance, he was not good. Like it wasn't really debatable. He was usually the worst guy out on the floor. And you flash forward to even this most recent summer league where he was solid. He shot the ball well, and you know, he was active at least on defense. And then, you know, the season he's had with the G League team, and now, you know, getting the call up and he got some shots up there against Indiana. Look, I just think that the amount of improvement that you've seen from him over the past two seasons is notable. It's something to be impressed by, because now he at least looks like a legit G League player, which I could not have said a couple of years ago. But you know, he is borderline enough where he got a two-way deal. So, you know, if a guy's improving at that rate and he shoots the ball like this, like he does, you know, undeniably he's a great shooter. Yeah, you know, hey, maybe he keeps up that trajectory. He keeps improving, keeps getting better, and makes the 15-man roster. I don't think it's out of the question. Like I said, I'd bet on Amude, but I don't think Buddy Boeheim's out of the question.
Yeah, the other thing with Buddy is next to Stanley, he has like equity within the organization as well. He's been there for 2 years now, and he was on the two-way his first season and started this year not on the two-way, just as like a standard G League player. I think it says a lot about a guy to go through that and work his way to a two-way and sort of head down, like work on your craft kind of thing, see where you can improve your game. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's big to do out of anyone. I don't think it's like, oh my gosh, YouTube user, you're killing me. You're distracting me in the chat right now. But yeah, I don't like see it long term by any means, but he's gotten better this season. There's no way you can question that.
All right, let's get to this next one here from John Pete Schwartz on Twitter. He asks, should the Pistons trade their first round pick this year? Which, you know, it's an interesting question, and I think that's one that we're going to really have to address probably all offseason up until the draft. So let's start now. What do you think? Do they need to consider moving that first round pick?
I mean, definitely consider it. I think it depends like where the team lands, like after these like hard conversations that everyone thinks that they're going to have this summer about the young pieces that they have. and if they fit together, if they're going to move on from one or multiple of them, what happens with that, I think, will impact what they do with their first round pick. Like, I think this year of any year, like, yeah, you should entertain trading your top five, top six pick, whatever it is. But there's a few guys that have sort of risen to that where you think they're not going to get by the top three, like Alex Saar and Zachary Risache. But like, it's also as wide open as we've seen a number one be in forever. So you don't know, like, while teams might question or be willing to like trade out of it, you don't know what teams are willing to trade up, because if it's someone that is in the first half of the lottery or the top 10, like if they have a guy that they want to just like go up and get, like they have no clue where he's going to go. They think he could go as high as 3, as low as 15. Like they might want to go up and get him, but they also might just want to see if they fall to them, like where they are. So while I think they maybe should, especially if it's number one and there's like a fit concern, I don't know if they'll be able to.
So I'll preface this by saying that, you know, the jury's obviously still out on this draft class. Someone could emerge here, and a bunch of guys actually could emerge and really become those top five locks, like we've seen in the past. We've seen multiple cases of like March Madness risers, late season risers, all this stuff. So, you know, that could happen. But as it stands right now, as we sit on, you know, really day one of March Madness in general, there's really no consensus at the top. And, you know, the narrative on this draft class is more or less agreed upon that it's not all that strong, at least not in terms of star level talent. I agree with you, but when you say, you know, you got to look at the other team, right, that might want to trade, that's exactly where I was going to go with this response. And that's that, you know, in order to trade that first round pick, someone else needs to value it really highly. I'm not even sure if you win the lottery this year, if you would get the types of offers for that pick that would make you really, really strongly consider it, because that other team wants it so much, right? I mean, for any trade to happen, someone else has to value the asset more than you do, which means it's going to be tough to find trade partners in a year where no one's really valuing the players in the draft, at least at that star level. So to me, I think the more likely scenario is actually probably one of the, you know, non-Cade Cunningham core guys getting moved, and then them making a selection there with their first overall pick. You know, I would just bet pretty strongly. I would be pretty confident in making the gamble that you're going to get better return on Jaden Ivey or Asar Thompson or Jalen Duren than you would this year's even number one overall pick. Do you think I'm out of pocket on that one at all?
No, not at all. And I also think, like, if we're talking most likely a top five pick, maybe top six, depending on where they end up in the standings, like, those picks don't get traded often as it is. Like, I mean, I'm probably missing something, but the one I can remember is when like Trey and Luka were swapped, and those were still two like top five picks. But I think GMs are like not scared, but don't really want to move off those picks, because I mean, the NBA draft, you're making it, if you're picking in the top five, you want someone to be like a key contributor, if not like a main building block of your future. And I don't know how many GMs are going to punt on that. And if they do, and they trade a pick to another team, and that whoever is picked in that just like is an all-star, all NBA level player, like that's something that's tough to stomach. And I don't know who's going to do that. Like, I doubt Weaver does it, to be honest, but it's an interesting conversation in like this year of all years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's definitely going to be in the cards. So let's get to this one here from the chat. This is from YouTube user, a guy. He says, there probably isn't time for this. Don't worry. There's time. We're hitting on it.
He says, time.
But who would be a semi-realistic wing or forward to target this offseason? He mentions Jeremy Grant, John Collins, DeAndre Hunter, Obi Toppin, Jalen Smith, Najee Marshall, etc. You know, there's a wide range of names there. Is there anyone else that you can think of? Who do you think they could target and also realistically get?
Well, I'll start with like Jeremy Grant, because I feel like that's kind of like realistic. I feel like Portland's gonna kind of want to get off of his long-term deal unless they want to keep him around as like a veteran, a guy who can get buckets. Like they have Malcolm Brogdon too, so maybe. But the name that like jumps out to me here is DeAndre Hunter. Like, do you think he's more gettable because of how awesome Jalen Johnson is?
I do. He's also a little older. And the contract that he's on, while it's not bad, it's not necessarily helpful to the Hawks to have a guy who it produces what he does, which is solid but not incredible, on that number when the rest of their books are pretty messy at this point. So I do actually think he's pretty gettable. That was a guy actually that I was fairly interested in at the trade deadline. If the Pistons could put together a package that was interesting enough for them. So yeah, DeAndre Hunter's pretty high on my, you know, want and could possibly get list for this offseason.
Yeah. Yeah. That one jumped out. Like, I think the Hawks are just like an interesting team in general. I don't really know what they're going to do. Like, who knows? Like, in theory, it should be like Trae Young and Jalen Johnson are who you're building around. But like, who knows? Like, Jalen Johnson's looking more like you're not letting that guy go for really like anything. And you don't know if a team who needs a point guard, like San Antonio or something like that, gives you a good package of interesting young pieces and picks for Trey. Like, do you just totally like retool? So they're an interesting team to me overall to see what they're going to do. So yeah, that's why of this list, like DeAndre Hunter sticks out to me, and he fills a role that this team could use.
Well, and a YouTube user brings up a good point that I want to touch on here in a later comment, but he says DeAndre Hunter is often injured and a better defender in theory than in practice. And I think this is really good to bring up as we kind of enter into the offseason, right? Because look, those reasons, they're both true. They're both very true, but that's also why he's gettable. That's all. And that those don't mean that he wouldn't be an improvement in Detroit. The situation for the Pistons is that their roster is really quite bad. So even getting a guy who is DeAndre Hunter-like, right, who's got these negatives, but is otherwise a very good player and a solid role player, like those negatives are why you could probably get him without trading a Jaden Ivey. It's when you start looking at these stars like a Jeremy Grant or a Mikal Bridges, or even like a Brandon Ingram, if the Pelicans were to consider splitting off someone from the Zion Williamson thing, right? Like, those are going to cost Jaden Ivey and maybe Jalen Duren plus other stuff. So if you're going to take those off the table and you want to keep them and build out the roster around them, maybe moving one of those four to the bench, what have you, right? Just adding more talent. DeAndre Hunter's a good guy to add. He fits really well, and he's not going to break the bank when you try to make a trade like this. And I think you could probably look into free agency as well, right? With a similar mindset. You know, guys that are going to get paid a lot are guys you probably, you know, maybe want to stay away from here if you don't want other dominoes to start falling. So I think that's just a good thing to bring up in general as we enter into the offseason, kind of the trade-offs that this organization is going to have to make as they hope to significantly improve this roster.
Yeah. And I haven't, just like another thing I was thinking, like, I haven't even really looked at I'm pretty confident that Jeremy Grant's around like $20 million a year, maybe more than that. But the other guys, like, I'm not I need to look closer at their deals, but we haven't even talked about like Cade's extension eligible this offseason. Like, if you're keeping these young guys around, you're going to have to pay them in the not so distant future. So it depends like who you can get and fit in around like whatever your books are going to look like in the next 1 to 2 years.
All right. So last question here. This is going to be from a fella in the DBB comments. I thought this was a really interesting one. So figured we may as well go a little bit over and hit on it. But he says, now that we're most of the way through the season, do any differences between Coach Monty Williams and Coach Dwayne Casey pop out to you?
Yeah, I think the immediate one that pops out is just like the rotations. I feel like we can definitely say that Monty has been a little set in his ways, if not stubborn, with like the rotations this season. I feel like maybe it is a bit recency bias, but maybe we did see a little bit more fluidity with Casey, and I guess just like playing guys that complement each other or shortening the rotation when he needs to. We've seen this season Monty's rotations get switched up a bit, but that might have been because his hand was forced a little bit by all the trades that were made, injuries, everything that has happened. Like, I mean, we know everything that Monty has done, like in turning organizations around and like player development wise. It's his first season, so like those things do need a little bit of time, maybe with the guys he's working with now, but I think they're pretty similar. If not Monty is a little bit better in like a player development aspect, we just haven't had the time to see that play out. So the main like difference really that sticks out to me is, yeah, just like rotations and what's going on with like the players that you're putting next to each other on the floor.
Yeah, that's a good call. That's a good call bringing that one up. I do think also recently, this might have been just after the most recent game, talking about Metu, Monty Williams just makes an offhand comment saying, you know, there were a couple times where he went and he tried, him being Metu, tried to do an isolation, go get a bucket for himself, and he pulled him aside and said, well, we only have a couple of guys that we have do that, and that's not going to be your role, right? And I bring this up because coming into the season, one of the things that I was actually excited about with Monty Williams, and this has more or less been the case as the season has gone on, is that there are really only a few guys on the roster that are going to be, you know, handling pick and rolls and getting isolation possessions. Outside of those guys, no one else is really going to do it all that much, right? So he really funnels down who's doing the majority of the ball handling. And Dwayne Casey did not. Dwayne Casey was kind of a free-for-all. It was, you know, he tried to have more of that free-flowing offense. There was less structure, a lot of DHOs, a lot of ISO, a lot of ball screens. Monty Williams hasn't done that. The one thing that he has kind of stayed true to this season that he's done in the past is that really it's Cade Cunningham and now a little bit of Fontecchio that's getting most of these ball handling duties. You're also seeing the backup point guard being Marcus Sasser getting them, and a little bit of Evan Fournier mixed in as well. I will quibble with Jaden Ivey because I think it took him way too long to give Jaden Ivey these looks, but you are starting to see him get them as well. And I've listed off now 5 total guys that are basically allowed to handle a pick and roll or take an isolation possession. For the most part, no one else is. I do think that's a good thing because other guys really shouldn't be doing those things. Like, do you really want Quentin Grimes just getting the top of the key ISO? I don't.
Yeah.
I really don't, you know? So I am happy about that one. And I do think that is something that's very different between Monty Williams and Dwayne Casey, even if, you know, I think they may have been a little bit better under Dwayne Casey to this point.
Yeah, for sure. And like I feel like towards the end of season, like there have been tough seasons now with both of them. We sort of saw momentum, I guess, pick up or not totally like lose steam. Like this season, yeah. especially, there have been some like backbreaking losses, including the game yep. against Indiana this week, the backbreaking loss against the Heat where Bam Adebayo gets that three-pointer off Cade's mistake. So all I can hope is, and I know we have a bunch of comments in the chat about whether Monty, like how Monty is handling the locker room and everything. I don't know. It just seems like we can see the, I don't want to say sadness, but just like disappointment on these guys' faces after some of the losses, where the past couple seasons we've seen them put together very good stretches of basketball when the season was already gone. It might not have been prolonged, but even if they got in a bit of a rut, we've seen them come out of it, which we've seen at points this year too, but it just feels like some of the losses are a bit more taken to heart.
I will say that I'm not sure how much of that is directly attributable to Monty Williams. I'm just going to be the Monty Williams defender, I guess. And I don't mean to, because I don't think he's done a great job this year. But, you know, in general, this is the first season where there were expectations. You know, Cade's rookie year, people were excited because he was the number one pick and he had all this potential. But there wasn't this expectation that they were going to be super competitive every night. Everyone, most fans at least, it seemed kind of felt like they knew they were ahead of their skis and they were okay with it. Last season, there were some expectations, especially with the exciting additions of Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren, Bojan Bogdanovic. But Cade Cunningham goes out. You know, he goes down with an injury. He's out for the year. All of those expectations kind of melted away, and no one expected anything more out of this team. But this season, you have a healthy Cade. You have year two, Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren. Top five pick, Ausar Thompson. You still have Bojan Bogdanovic, who played really well the season prior. And you just brought in this new head coach who, by all accounts, has only found success everywhere that he's gone. And you just paid him big bucks to come to Detroit as well. There were expectations to start this year. And I'm not saying that it's, you know, a good thing that impacted the players, but you know, they're human beings, right? If you're going into the season expecting to, you know, win more than 30 games, be competitive, you know, into March, where you're kind of in the play-in hunt, even if you're at the bottom tier of it, and then you lose 28 games in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty backbreaking, you know, like the split, the discrepancy between what you thought this year was going to be and what it turned into is so vast this season when it hasn't been in the past. And guys, they're human beings. I think that's unavoidable. And I don't think that's on Monty Williams, even though admittedly some of his decisions have absolutely, absolutely contributed to the losses. You can't say that the 28 straight losses were all on Monty Williams. He's not playing the games. So, yeah, that's my soapbox there about why this team looks so dejected right now. Because I agree, they do. They look dead. There's that video of Cade after the Pacers game just staring through the camera with anger as the Pacers wind down the clock. And you're just like, oh my God, this is not good.
I kind of feel bad for Cade because I kind of wonder if like cameras are catching him just in bad moments. Like, I remember the same thing happened after that Utah loss during the losing streak when he was walking off the floor and like looks like he was almost just in tears. Like, I feel bad for the guy, but I also do wonder if just the broadcast is catching him at the wrong time. But hopefully, like, I mean, they just got to like put it in the past and come out and do what they can to hopefully string together a few wins. I mean, I think it's going to be tough from here on out the rest of the season, especially with Ausar Thompson and Isaiah Stewart missing the rest of the year and other guys out with injury. But you're right. Like, the context of the expectations of the season are different. So, yeah, that's not fully on Monty. It's on, like, the situation that he came in.
And I'll just say this quickly. This was something that our guy, fellow DBBer Brady Fredrickson, he had said before the season started. This was actually before this show was the pin down. This was back when it was DBB Live, back over the off season. And pretty shortly after the hiring of Monty Williams, we have Brady on, and Brady just makes this very simple comment, and it's stuck with me ever since. And he was saying that for him, this season is going to be a success if those, you know, 1,000-yard stares that you'd see near the end of games this past season, if those went away. And they haven't. So even with all of this, I do everything that I just said. That does not mean this season was not a failure. It was, objectively. It's been an absolute failure. But yeah, that was shout out to Brady. Love Brady. Well, we need to get him back on sometime here shortly.
Yeah, we do. Shout out to Brady if you're listening. And yeah, that's a good measure of success for us moving forward if those go away. But yeah, I mean, the Pistons have a couple games against Boston and New Orleans coming up, and then they go on a 3-game road trip to New York, Minnesota, and Washington. So, I mean, that Washington game, hopefully they can compete, but not an easy stretch coming up. So, yeah, man, just hope these guys can get one.
And if you're looking for morbid intrigue to continue turning into Pistons games this season, they need to win 4 games to not set a record for most losses in a single season for the Pistons. Can they do it? It's not a good reason to watch, but it's an interesting one. We've got a little bit over, so everyone, thank you for sticking with us here on the live show. And obviously listening, if you're listening on podcast in your car or just with headphones, we appreciate you guys. We're going to wrap it up. Blake, take it away, my man.
Yeah, thank you to everyone. And yeah, I was trying to find a way to end it on a higher note, but I think one is with March Madness going on, we're definitely going to be talking more.
I know it's elusive today.
Yeah, I know. But hey, it's about to be draft season. We don't have much, I guess, meaningful Pistons basketball coming our way for the rest of the season. So we'll have some fun talking about future prospects, what the future is going to look like. And thank you to everyone who joined live with us while on the first day of March Madness. I seriously am like blown away with the numbers we're getting on live every week. So thank you all for joining with us. And special thanks to Sean Corp, managing editor of Detroit Bad Boys, for supporting the show. Shout out to you guys for all the great questions and talking points tonight. We'll catch you next week, whether on your commute or live with us here on YouTube or Twitter. We can't wait to talk Detroit basketball with you all.